objective criteria should be not only independent of will, but also both legitimate and practical. In a boundary dispute, for example, you may find it easier to agree on a physically salient feature such as a river than on a line 3 yards to the east of the riverbank. Objective criteria should apply, at least in theory, to both sides. You can thus use the test of reciprocal application to tell you whether a proposed criterion is fair and independent of either party's will. If a real estate agency selling you a house offers a standard form contract, you would be wise to ask if that is the same standard form they use when they buy a house. In the international arena, the principle of self-determination is notorious for the number of peoples who insist on it as a fundamental right, but deny its applicability to those on the other side. Consider the Middle East, Kashmir, or Cyprus as just three examples. Fair procedures. To produce an outcome independent of will, you can use either fair standards for the substantive question or fair procedures for resolving the conflicting interests. Consider, for example, the age-old way to divide a piece of cake between two children. One cuts and the other chooses. Neither can complain about an unfair division. This simple procedure was used in the Law of the Sea negotiations, one of the most complex negotiations ever undertaken. At one point, the issue of how to allocate mining sites in the deep seabed deadlocked the negotiation. Under the terms of the draft agreement, half the sites were to be mined by private companies, the other half by the Enterprise, a mining organization to be owned by the United Nations. Since the private mining companies from the rich nations had the technology and the expertise to choose the best sites, the poor nations feared the less knowledgeable Enterprise would receive a bad bargain. The solution devised was to agree that a private company seeking to mine the seabed would present the Enterprise with two proposed mining sites. The Enterprise would pick one site for itself and grant the company a license to mine the other. Since the company would not know which site it would get, it would have an incentive to make both sites as promising as possible. This simple procedure thus harnessed the company's superior expertise for mutual gain. A variation on the procedure of one cuts, the other chooses, is for the parties to negotiate what they think is a fair arrangement before they go on to decide their respective roles in it. In a divorce negotiation, for example, before deciding which parent will get custody of the children, the parents might agree on the visiting rights and responsibilities of the other parent. This gives both an incentive to agree on visitation rights each will think fair. As you consider procedural solutions, look at other basic means of settling differences, taking turns, drawing lots, letting someone else decide, and so on. Frequently, taking turns presents the best way for heirs to divide a large number of heirlooms left to them collectively. Afterwards, they can do some trading if they want, or they can make the selection tentative so they see how it comes out before committing themselves to accept it. Drawing lots, flipping a coin, and other forms of chance have an inherent fairness. The results may be unequal, but each side had an equal opportunity. Letting someone else play a key role in a joint decision is a well-established procedure with almost infinite variations. The parties can agree to submit a particular question to an expert for advice or decision. They can ask a mediator to help them reach a decision. Or they can submit the matter to an arbitrator for an authoritative and binding decision. Professional baseball, for example, uses last best offer arbitration to settle players' salary disputes. The arbitrator must choose between the last offer made by one side and the last offer made by the other. The theory is that this procedure puts pressure on the parties to make their proposals more reasonable. In baseball, and in states where this form of arbitration is compulsory for certain public employee disputes, it does seem to produce more settlements than in comparable circumstances where there is a commitment to conventional arbitration. Those parties who don't settle, however, sometimes give the arbitrator an unpleasant choice between two extreme offers. Negotiating with objective criteria. Having identified some objective criteria and procedures, how do you go about discussing them with the other side? There are three basic points to remember. One, frame each issue as a joint search for objective criteria. Two, reason and be open to reason as to which standards are most appropriate and how they should be applied. Three, never yield to pressure, only to principle. In short, focus on objective criteria firmly, but flexibly. Frame each issue as a joint search for objective criteria. If you are negotiating to buy a house, you might start off by saying, "Look, you want a high price and I want a low price. Let's figure out what a fair price would be, what objective standards might be most relevant." You and the other side may have conflicting interests, but the two of you now have a shared goal, to determine a fair price. You might begin by suggesting one or more criteria yourself. The cost of the house adjusted for depreciation and inflation, recent sale prices of similar houses in the neighborhood, or an independent appraisal, and then invite the seller's suggestions. Ask, "What's your theory?" If the seller starts by giving you a position, such as, "The price is $255,000, ask for the theory behind that price. How did you arrive at that figure? Treat the problem as though the seller, too, is looking for a fair price based on objective criteria. Agree first on principles. Before even considering possible terms, you may want to agree on the standard or standards to apply. Each standard the other side proposes becomes a lever you can then use to persuade them. Your case will have more impact if it is presented in terms of that criteria, and they will find it difficult to resist applying their criteria to the problem. You say Mr. Jones sold the house next door for $260,000. Your theory is that this house should be sold for what comparable houses in the neighborhood are going for, am I right? In that case, let's look at what the house on the corner of Ellsworth and Oxford and the one at Broadway and Dana were sold for. What makes conceding particularly difficult is having to accept someone else's proposal. If they suggested the standard, their deferring to it is not an act of weakness, but an act of strength, of carrying out their word. Reason and be open to reason. What makes the negotiation a joint search is that, however much you may have prepared various objective criteria, you come to the table with an open mind. In most negotiations, people use precedent and other objective standards simply as arguments in support of a position. A police union might, for example, insist upon a raise of a certain amount and then justify their position with arguments about what police in other cities make. This use of standards usually only digs people even deeper into their position. Going one step further, some people begin by announcing that their position is an issue of principle and refuse even to consider the other side's case. "It's a matter of principle" becomes a battle cry in a holy war over ideology. Practical differences escalate into principled ones, further locking in the negotiators rather than freeing them. This is emphatically not what is meant by principled negotiation. Insisting that an agreement be based on objective criteria does not mean insisting that it be based solely on the criterion you advance. One standard of legitimacy does not preclude the existence of others. What the other side believes to be fair may not be what you believe to be fair. You should behave like a judge. Although you may be predisposed to one side, in this case your own, you should be willing to respond to reasons for applying another standard or for applying a standard differently. When each party is advancing a different standard, look for an objective basis for deciding between them, such as which standard has been used by the parties in the past or which standard is more widely applied. Just as the substantive issue itself should not be settled on the basis of will, neither should the question of which standard applies. In a given case, there may be two standards, such as market value and depreciated cost, that produce different results but that both parties agree seem equally legitimate. In that case, splitting the difference or otherwise compromising between the results suggested by the two objective standards is perfectly legitimate. The outcome is still independent of the will of the parties. If, however, after a thorough discussion of the merits of an issue, you still cannot accept their proposed criteria as the most appropriate, you might suggest putting them to a test. Agree on someone you both regard as fair and give him or her a list of the proposed criteria. Ask the person to decide which are the fairest or most appropriate for your situation. Since objective criteria are supposed to be legitimate and because legitimacy implies acceptance by a great many people, this is a fair thing to ask. You are not asking the third party to settle your substantive dispute, just to give you advice on what standard to use in settling it. The difference between seeking agreement on the appropriate principles for deciding a matter and using principles simply as arguments to support positions is sometimes subtle, but always significant. A principled negotiator is open to reasoned persuasion on the merits. A positional bargainer is not. It is the combination of openness to reason with insistence on a solution based on objective criteria that makes principled negotiation so persuasive and so effective at getting the other side to play. Never yield to pressure. Consider once again the example of negotiating with the contractor. What if he offers to hire your brother-in-law on the condition that you give in on the depth of the foundations? You would probably answer, "A job for my brother-in-law has nothing to do with whether the house will be safely supported on a foundation of that depth." What if the contractor then threatens to charge you a higher price? You would answer the same way. "We'll settle that question on the merits, too. Let's see what other contractors charge for this kind of work." Or, "Bring me your cost figures and we'll work out a fair profit margin." If the contractor replies, "Come on, you trust me, don't you?" You would respond, "Trust is an entirely separate matter. The issue is how deep the foundations have to be to make the house safe." Pressure can take many forms: a bribe, a threat, a manipulative appeal to trust, or a simple refusal to budge. In all these cases, the principled response is the same. Invite them to state their reasoning, suggest objective criteria you think apply, and refuse to budge except on this basis. Never yield to pressure, only to principle. Who will prevail? In any given case, it is impossible to say, but in general, you will have an edge. For in addition to your willpower, you also have the power of legitimacy and the persuasiveness of remaining open to reason. It will be easier for you to resist making an arbitrary concession than it will be for them to resist advancing some objective standards. A refusal to yield except in response to sound reasons is an easier position to defend, publicly and privately, than is a refusal to yield combined with a refusal to advance sound reasons. At the least, you will usually prevail on the question of process. You can usually shift the process from positional bargaining to a search for objective criteria. In this sense, principled negotiation is a dominant strategy over positional bargaining. One who insists that negotiation be based on the merits can bring others around to playing that game, since that becomes the only way to advance their substantive interests. On substance, too, you are likely to do well, particularly for those who might otherwise be browbeaten by a positional bargainer. Principled negotiation allows you to hold your own and still be fair. Principle serves as your hard-hearted partner who will not let you yield to pressure. It is a form of right makes might. If the other side truly will not budge and will not advance a persuasive basis for their position, then there is no further negotiation. You now have a choice like the one you face when you walk into a store that has a fixed, non-negotiable price on what you want to buy. You can take it or leave it. Before leaving it, you should see if you have overlooked some objective standard that makes their offer a fair one. If you find such a standard, and if you would rather reach agreement on that basis than have no agreement, do so. The availability of that relevant standard avoids the cost of giving in to an arbitrary position. If there is no give in their position, and you find no principled basis for accepting it, you should assess what you might gain by accepting their unjustified position rather than going to your best alternative. You should weigh that substantive benefit against the benefit to your reputation as a principled negotiator that could come from walking away. Shifting discussion in a negotiation from the question of what the other side is willing to do to the question of how the matter ought to be decided does not end argument, nor does it guarantee a favorable result. It does, however, provide a strategy you can vigorously pursue without the high costs of positional bargaining. It's company policy. Let's look at a real case where one party used positional bargaining and the other principled negotiation. Tom, one of our colleagues, had his parked car totally destroyed by a dump truck. The car was covered by insurance, but the exact amount Tom could recover remained for him to work out with the insurance adjuster. Insurance adjuster, we've studied your case and we have decided the policy applies. That means you're entitled to a settlement of $13,600. Tom, I see. How did you reach that figure? Insurance adjuster, that's how much we decided the car was worth. Tom, I understand, but what standard did you use to determine that amount? Do you know where I can buy a comparable car for that much? How much are you asking for? Whatever I'm entitled to under the policy. I found a second-hand car just about like it for $17,700. Adding the sales and excise tax, it would come to about $19,000.
$19,000? That's too much.
I'm not asking for $19,000 or $18,000 or $20,000, but for fair compensation. Do you agree that it's only fair I get enough to replace the car?
Okay, I'll offer you $15,000. That's the highest I can go, company policy.
How does the company figure that?
Look, $15,000 is all you get. Take it or leave it.
Well, $15,000 may be fair. I don't know. I certainly understand your position if you're bound by company policy. But unless you can state objectively why that amount is what I'm entitled to, I think I'll do better in court. Why don't we study the matter and talk again? Is Wednesday at 11 a good time to talk?
Okay, Mr. Griffith, I've got an ad here in today's paper offering a car exactly the same make, model, and year as yours for $14,800.
I see. What does it say about the mileage?
49,000. Why?
Because mine only had 25,000 miles. How many dollars does that increase the worth in your book?
Let me see. 1,650.
Assuming the $14,800 is one possible base, that brings the figure to $16,450. Does the ad specify the technology package?
No.
How much extra for that in your book?
$1,100.
How about an auto-dimming mirror?
A half hour later, Tom walked out with a check for $18,024.
Part 3.
Yes, but...
Chapter 6. What if they are more powerful? Develop your BATNA. Best alternative to a negotiated agreement. Of what use is talking about interests, options, and standards if the other side has a stronger bargaining position? What do you do if the other side is richer or better connected, or if they have a larger staff or more powerful weapons? No method can guarantee success if all the leverage lies on the other side. No book on gardening can teach you to grow lilies in a desert or a cactus in a swamp. If you enter an antique store to buy a sterling silver George IV tea set worth thousands of dollars, and all you have is $100 bill, you should not expect skillful negotiation to overcome the difference. In any negotiation, there exist realities that are hard to change. In response to power, the most any method of negotiation can do is meet two objectives. First, to protect you against making an agreement you should reject, and second, to help you make the most of the assets you do have so that any agreement you reach will satisfy your interests as well as possible. Let's take each objective in turn. Protecting yourself. When you are trying to catch an airplane, your goal may seem tremendously important. Looking back on it, you see you could have caught the next plane. Negotiation will often present you with a similar situation. You will worry, for instance, about failing to reach agreement on an important business deal in which you have invested a great deal of yourself. Under these conditions, a major danger is that you will be too accommodating to the views of the other side, too quick to go along. The siren song of, "Let's all agree and put an end to this," becomes persuasive. You may end up with a deal you should have rejected. The costs of using a bottom line. Negotiators commonly try to protect themselves against such an outcome by establishing in advance the worst acceptable outcome, their bottom line. If you are buying, a bottom line is the highest price you would pay. If you are selling, a bottom line is the lowest amount you would accept. You and your spouse might, for example, ask $300,000 for your house and agree between yourselves to accept no offer below $260,000. Having a bottom line makes it easier to resist pressure and temptations of the moment. In the house example, it might be impossible for a buyer to pay more than $244,000, and everyone involved may know that you bought the house not so long ago for only $235,000. In this situation, where you have the power to produce agreement and the buyer does not, the brokers and anyone else in the room may turn to you. Your predetermined bottom line may save you from making a decision you would later regret. If there is more than one person on your side, jointly adopting a bottom line helps ensure that no one will indicate to the other side that you might settle for less. It limits the authority of a lawyer, broker, or other agent. Get the best price you can, but you are not authorized to sell for less than $260,000, you might say.
If your side is a loose coalition of newspaper unions negotiating with an association of publishers, agreement on a bottom line reduces the risk that one union will be split off by offers from the other side. But the protection afforded by adopting a bottom line involves high costs. It limits your ability to benefit from what you learn during negotiation. By definition, a bottom line is a position that is not to be changed. To that extent, you have shut your ears, deciding in advance that nothing the other party says could cause you to raise or lower that bottom line. A bottom line also inhibits imagination. It reduces the incentive to invent a tailor-made solution that would reconcile differing interests in a way more advantageous for both you and them. Almost every negotiation involves more than one variable. Rather than simply selling your place for $260,000, you might serve your interest better by settling for $235,000 with a first refusal on resale, a delayed closing, the right to use the barn for storage for 2 years, and an option to buy back 2 acres of the pasture. If you insist on a bottom line, you are not likely to explore an imaginative solution like this. A bottom line, by its very nature rigid, is almost certain to be too rigid. Moreover, a bottom line is likely to be set too high. Suppose you are sitting around the breakfast table with your family trying to decide the lowest price you should accept for your house. One family member suggests $200,000. Another replies, "We should get at least $240,000. A third chimes in, "$240,000 for our house? That would be a steal. It's worth at least $300,000. Who sitting at the table will object, knowing they will benefit from a higher price? Once decided upon, such a bottom line may be hard to change and may prevent your selling the house when you should. Under other circumstances, a bottom line may be too low. Rather than selling at such a figure, you would have been better off renting. In short, while adopting a bottom line may protect you from accepting a very bad agreement, it may keep you both from inventing and from agreeing to a solution it would be wise to accept. An arbitrarily selected figure is no measure of what you should accept. Is there an alternative to the bottom line? Is there a measure for agreements that will protect you against both accepting an agreement you should reject and rejecting an agreement you should accept? There is. Know your BATNA. When a family is deciding on the minimum price for their house, the right question for them to ask is not what they ought to be able to get, but what they will do if by a certain time they have not sold the house. Will they keep it on the market indefinitely? Will they rent it, tear it down, turn the land into a parking lot, let someone else live in it rent-free on condition they paint it, or what? Which of those alternatives is most attractive, all things considered? And how does that alternative compare with the best offer received for the house? It may be that one of those alternatives is more attractive than selling the house for $260,000. On the other hand, selling the house for as little as $224,000 may be better than holding on to it indefinitely. It is most unlikely that any arbitrarily selected bottom line truly reflects the family's interests. The reason you negotiate is to produce something better than the results you can obtain without negotiating. What are those results? What is that alternative? What is your BATNA, your best alternative to a negotiated agreement? That is the standard against which any proposed agreement should be measured. That is the only standard that can protect you both from accepting terms that are too unfavorable and from rejecting terms it would be in your interest to accept. Your BATNA not only is a better measure, but also has the advantage of being flexible enough to permit the exploration of imaginative solutions. Instead of ruling out any solution that does not meet your bottom line, you can compare a proposal with your BATNA to see whether it better satisfies your interests. The insecurity of an unknown BATNA. If you have not thought carefully about what you will do if you fail to reach an agreement, you are negotiating with your eyes closed. You may, for instance, be too optimistic and assume that you have many other choices, other houses for sale, other buyers for your second-hand car, other plumbers, other jobs available, other wholesalers, and so on. Even when your alternative is fixed, you may be taking too rosy a view of the consequences of not reaching agreement. You may not be appreciating the full agony of a lawsuit, a contested divorce, a strike, an arms race, or a war. One frequent mistake is psychologically to see your alternatives in the aggregate. You may be telling yourself that if you do not reach agreement on a salary for this job, you could always go to California, or go south, or go back to school, or write, or work on a farm, or live in Paris, or do something else. In your mind, you are likely to find the sum of these alternatives more attractive than working for a specific salary in a particular job. The difficulty is that you cannot have the sum total of all those other alternatives. If you fail to reach agreement, you will have to choose just one. In most circumstances, however, the greater danger is that you are too committed to reaching agreement. Not having developed any alternative to a negotiated solution, you are unduly pessimistic about what would happen if negotiations broke off. As valuable as knowing your BATNA may be, you may hesitate to explore alternatives. You hope this buyer or the next will make you an attractive offer for the house. You may avoid facing the question of what you will do if no agreement is reached. You may think to yourself, let's negotiate first and see what happens. If things don't work out, then I'll figure out what to do. But having at least a tentative answer to the question is absolutely essential if you are to conduct your negotiations wisely. Whether you should or should not agree on something in a negotiation depends entirely upon the attractiveness to you of the best available alternative. Formulate a tripwire. Although your BATNA is the true measure by which you should judge any proposed agreement, you may want another test as well. To give you early warning that the content of a possible agreement is beginning to run the risk of being too unattractive, it is useful to identify one far from perfect agreement that is better than your BATNA. Before accepting any agreement worse than this tripwire package, you should take a break and re-examine the situation. Like a bottom line, a tripwire can limit the authority of an agent. Don't sell for less than $258,000, the price I paid plus interest, until you've talked to me. A tripwire should provide you with some margin in reserve. If after reaching the standard reflected in your tripwire you decide to call in a mediator, you have left him with something on your side to work with. You still have some room to move. Making the most of your assets. Protecting yourself against a bad agreement is one thing. Making the most of the assets you have to produce a good agreement is another. How do you do this? Again, the answer lies in your BATNA. The better your BATNA, the greater your power. People think of negotiating power as being determined by resources like wealth, political connections, physical strength, friends, and military might. In fact, the relative negotiating power of two parties depends primarily upon how attractive to each is the option of not reaching agreement. Consider a wealthy tourist who wants to buy a small brass pot for a modest price from a vendor at the Mumbai railroad station. The vendor may be poor, but she is likely to know the market. If she does not sell the pot to this tourist, she can sell it to another. From her experience, she can estimate when and for how much she could sell it to someone else. The tourist may be wealthy and powerful, but in this negotiation he will be weak indeed, unless he knows approximately how much it would cost and how difficult it would be to find a comparable pot elsewhere. He is almost certain either to miss his chance to buy such a pot or to pay too high a price. The tourist's wealth in no way strengthens his negotiating power. If apparent, it weakens his ability to buy the pot at a low price. To convert that wealth into negotiating power, the tourist would have to apply it to learn about the price at which he could buy an equally or more attractive brass pot somewhere else. Think for a moment about how you would feel walking into a job interview with no other job offers, only some uncertain leads. Think how the talk about salary would go. Now contrast that with how you would feel walking in with two other job offers. How would that salary negotiation proceed? The difference is power. What is true for negotiations between individuals is equally true for negotiations between organizations. The relative negotiating power of a large industry and a small town trying to raise taxes on a factory is determined not only by the relative size of their respective budgets, or their political clout, but by each side's best alternative. In one case, a small town negotiated a company with a factory just outside the town limits from a goodwill payment of $300,000 a year to one of $2,300,000 a year. How? The town knew exactly what it would do if no agreement was reached. It would expand the town limits to include the factory and then tax the factory the full residential rate of some $2,500,000 a year. The corporation had committed itself to keeping the factory. It had developed no alternative to reaching agreement. At first glance, the corporation seemed to have a great deal of power. It provided most of the jobs in the town, which was suffering economically. A factory shutdown or relocation would devastate the town, and the taxes the corporation was already paying helped provide the salaries of the very town leaders who were demanding more. Yet all of these assets, because they were not converted into a good BATNA, proved of little use. Having an attractive BATNA, the small town had more ability to affect the outcome of the negotiation than did one of the world's largest corporations. Develop your BATNA. Vigorous exploration of what you will do if you do not reach agreement can greatly strengthen your hand. Attractive alternatives are not just sitting there waiting for you. You usually have to develop them. Generating possible BATNAs requires three distinct operations. 1. Inventing a list of actions you might conceivably take if no agreement is reached. 2. Improving some of the more promising ideas and converting them into practical alternatives. And 3. Selecting, tentatively, the one alternative that seems best. The first operation is inventing. If by the end of the month, Company X does not make you a satisfactory job offer, what are some things you might do? Take a job with Company Y? Look in another city? Start a business on your own? What else? For a labor union, alternatives to a negotiated agreement would presumably include calling a strike, working without a contract, giving a 60-day notice of a strike, asking for a mediator, and calling on union members to work to rule. The second stage is to improve the best of your ideas and turn the most promising into real alternatives. If you are thinking about working in Chicago, try to turn that idea into at least one job offer there. With a Chicago job offer in hand, or even having discovered that you are unable to produce one, you are much better prepared to assess the merits of a New York offer. While a labor union is still negotiating, it should convert the ideas of calling in a mediator and of striking into drafts of specific operational decisions ready for execution. The union might, for instance, take a vote of its membership to authorize a strike if a settlement is not achieved by the time the contract expires. The final step in developing a BATNA is selecting the best among the alternatives. If you do not reach agreement in the negotiations, which of your realistic alternatives do you now plan to pursue? Having gone through this effort, you now have a BATNA. Judge every offer against it. The better your BATNA, the greater your ability to improve the terms of any negotiated agreement. Knowing what you are going to do if the negotiation does not lead to agreement will give you additional confidence in the negotiating process. It is easier to break off negotiations if you know where you're going. The greater your willingness to break off negotiations, the more forcefully you can present your interests and the basis on which you believe an agreement should be reached. The desirability of disclosing your BATNA to the other side depends upon your assessment of the other side's thinking. If your BATNA is extremely attractive, if you have another customer waiting in the next room, it is in your interest to let the other side know. If they think you lack a good alternative when in fact you have one, then you should almost certainly let them know. However, if your best alternative to a negotiated agreement is worse for you than they think, disclosing it will weaken rather than strengthen your hand. Consider the other side's BATNA. You should also think about the alternatives to a negotiated agreement available to the other side. The more you can learn of their alternatives, the better prepared you are for negotiation. Knowing their alternatives, you can realistically estimate what you can expect from the negotiation. They may be unduly optimistic about what they can do if no agreement is reached. Perhaps they have a vague notion that they have a great many alternatives and are under the influence of their cumulative total. If they appear to overestimate their BATNA, you will want to help them think through whether their expectations are realistic. Their BATNA may be better for them than any fair solution you can imagine. Suppose you are a community group concerned about the potential noxious gases to be emitted by a power plant now under construction. The power company's BATNA is either to ignore your protests altogether, or to keep you talking while they finish building the plant. To get them to take your concerns seriously, you may have to file a lawsuit seeking to have their construction permit revoked. In other words, if their BATNA is so good they don't see any need to negotiate on the merits, consider what you can do to change it. If both sides have attractive BATNAs, the best outcome of the negotiation for both parties may well be not to reach agreement. In such cases, a successful negotiation is one in which you and they amicably and efficiently discover that the best way to advance your respective interests is for each of you to look elsewhere and not to try further to reach agreement. When the other side is powerful. If the other side has big guns, you do not want to turn a negotiation into a gunfight. The stronger they appear in terms of physical or economic power, the more you benefit by negotiating on the merits. To the extent that they have muscle and you have principle, the larger a role you can establish for principle, the better off you are. Having a good BATNA can help you negotiate on the merits. You can convert such resources as you have into effective negotiating power by developing and improving your BATNA. Apply knowledge, time, money, people, connections, and wits into devising the best solution for you independent of the other side's assent. The more easily and happily you can walk away from a negotiation, the greater your capacity to affect its outcome. Developing your BATNA thus not only enables you to determine what is a minimally acceptable agreement, it will probably raise that minimum. Developing your BATNA is perhaps the most effective course of action you can take in dealing with a seemingly more powerful negotiator. Chapter 7. What if they won't play? Use negotiation jujitsu. Talking about interests, options, and standards may be a wise, efficient, and amicable game, but what if the other side won't play? While you try to discuss interests, they may state their position in unequivocal terms. You may be concerned with developing possible agreements to maximize the gains of both parties. They may be attacking your proposals, concerned only with maximizing their own gains. You may attack the problem on its merits. They may attack you. What can you do to turn them away from positions and toward the merits? There are three basic approaches for focusing their attention on the merits. The first centers on what you can do. You yourself can concentrate on the merits rather than on positions. This method, the subject of this book, is contagious. It holds open the prospect of success to those who will talk about interests, options, and criteria. In effect, you can change the game simply by starting to play a new one. If this doesn't work and they continue to use positional bargaining, you can resort to a second strategy that focuses on what they may do. It counters the basic moves of positional bargaining in ways that direct their attention to the merits. This strategy we call negotiation jujitsu. The third approach focuses on what a third party can do. If neither principled negotiation nor negotiation jujitsu gets them to play, consider including a third party trained to focus the discussion on interests, options, and criteria. Perhaps the most effective tool a third party can use in such an effort is the one-text mediation procedure. The first approach, principled negotiation, has already been discussed. Negotiation jujitsu and the one-text procedure are explained in this chapter. The chapter ends with a dialogue based on an actual landlord-tenant negotiation that illustrates in detail how you might persuade an unwilling party to play using a combination of principled negotiation and negotiation jujitsu. Negotiation jujitsu. If the other side announces a firm position, you may be tempted to criticize and reject it. If they criticize your proposal, you may be tempted to defend it and dig yourself in. If they attack you, you may be tempted to defend yourself and counterattack. In short, if they push you hard, you will tend to push back. Yet if you do, you will end up playing the positional bargaining game. Rejecting their position only locks them in. Defending your proposal only locks you in. And defending yourself sidetracks the negotiation into a clash of personalities. You will find yourself in a vicious cycle of attack and defense, and you will waste a lot of time and energy in useless pushing and pulling. If pushing back does not work, what does? How can you prevent the cycle of action and reaction? Do not push back. When they assert their positions, do not reject them. When they attack your ideas, don't defend them. When they attack you, don't counterattack. Break the vicious cycle by refusing to react. Instead of pushing back, sidestep their attack and deflect it against the problem. As in the oriental martial arts of judo and jiu-jitsu, avoid pitting your strength against theirs directly. Instead, use your skill to step aside and turn their strength to your ends. Rather than resisting their force, channel it into exploring interests, inventing options for mutual gain, and searching for independent standards. How does negotiation jiu-jitsu work in practice? How do you sidestep their attack and deflect it against the problem? Typically, their attack will consist of three maneuvers: asserting their position forcefully, attacking your ideas, and attacking you. Let's consider how a principled negotiator can deal with each of these. Don't attack their position, look behind it. When the other side sets forth their position, neither reject it nor accept it. Treat it as one possible option. Look for the interests behind it. Seek out the principles that it reflects and think about ways to improve it. Let's say you represent an association of teachers striking for higher pay and for seniority as the only criterion in layoffs. The school board has proposed a $2,000 raise across the board, plus retention of the right to decide unilaterally who gets laid off. Mind their position for the interests that lie below the surface. What exactly are the budget trade-offs involved in raising the salary schedule more than $2,000? Why do you feel a need to maintain complete control over layoffs? Assume every position they take is a genuine attempt to address the basic concerns of each side. Ask them how they think it addresses the problem at hand. Treat their position as one option and objectively examine the extent to which it meets the interests of each party, or might be improved to do so. How will a $2,000 across-the-board increase keep our school's salaries competitive with others in the area, and thus assure that the students will have high-quality teachers? How could you satisfy the teachers that your evaluation procedure for layoffs would be fair? We believe that you personally would be fair, but what would happen if you left? How can we leave our livelihoods and our families' well-being up to a potentially arbitrary decision? Seek out and discuss the principles underlying the other side's positions. What is the theory that makes $2,000 a fair salary increase? Is it based on what other schools pay or what others with comparable qualifications make? Do you believe that the town's least experienced teacher should be laid off first or the most experienced, who, of course, have higher salaries? To direct their attention toward improving the options on the table, discuss with them hypothetically what would happen if one of their positions was accepted. In 1970, an American lawyer had a chance to interview President Gamal Abdel Nasser of Egypt on the subject of the Arab-Israeli conflict. He asked Nasser, "What do you want Israel's Prime Minister Golda Meir to do?" Nasser replied, "Withdraw." "Withdraw?" the lawyer asked. "Withdraw from every inch of Arab territory." "Without a deal? With nothing from you?" the American asked incredulously. "Nothing. It's our territory. She should promise to withdraw," Nasser replied. The American asked, "What would happen to Golda Meir if tomorrow morning she appeared on Israeli radio and television and said, 'On behalf of the people of Israel, I hereby promise to withdraw from every inch of territory occupied in 1967, the Sinai Peninsula, the Gaza Strip, the West Bank, Jerusalem, the Golan Heights, and I want you to know I have no commitment of any kind from any Arab whatsoever.'" Nasser burst out laughing. "Oh, would she have trouble at home?" Understanding what an unrealistic option Egypt had been offering Israel may have contributed to Nasser's stated willingness later that day to accept a ceasefire in the ongoing hostilities. Don't defend your ideas. Invite criticism and advice. A lot of time in negotiation is spent criticizing. Rather than resisting the other side's criticism, invite it. Instead of asking them to accept or reject an idea, ask them what's wrong with it. What concerns of yours would this salary proposal fail to take into account? Examine their negative judgments to find out their underlying interests and to improve your ideas from their point of view. Rework your ideas in light of what you learn from them, and thus turn criticism from an obstacle in the process of working toward agreement into an essential ingredient of that process. If I understand you, you're saying you can't afford to give 750 teachers more than a $2,000 across-the-board raise. What if we accept that with the stipulation that any money saved by hiring fewer than 750 full-time teachers will be distributed as a monthly bonus to those teachers who are working? Another way to channel criticism in a constructive direction is to turn the situation around and ask for their advice. Ask them what they would do if they were in your position. If your jobs were at stake, what would you do? Our members are feeling so insecure about their jobs and frustrated by their shrinking dollars, they're talking about inviting a militant union in to represent them. If you were leading this association, how would you act? Thus, you lead them to confront your half of the problem. In doing so, they may be able to invent a solution that meets your concerns. Part of the problem here seems to be that the teachers feel no one's listening. Would it help to have regular sessions at which teachers could meet with the school board? Recast an attack on you as an attack on the problem. When the other side attacks you personally, as frequently happens, resist the temptation to defend yourself or to attack them. Instead, sit back and allow them to let off steam. Listen to them, show you understand what they are saying, and when they have finished, recast their attack on you as an attack on the problem. When you say that a strike shows we don't care about the children, I hear your concern about the children's education. I want you to know that we share this concern. They are our children and our students. We want the strike to end so we can go back to educating them. What can we both do now to reach an agreement as quickly as possible? Ask questions and pause. Those engaged in negotiation jujitsu use two key tools. The first is to use questions instead of statements. Statements generate resistance, whereas questions generate answers. Questions allow the other side to get their points across and let you understand them. They pose challenges and can be used to lead the other side to confront the problem. Questions offer them no target to strike at, no position to attack. Questions do not criticize, they educate. Do you think it would be better to have teachers cooperating in a process they felt they were participating in, or actively resisting one they felt was imposed on them and failed to take their concerns into account? Silence is one of your best weapons. Use it. If they have made an unreasonable proposal or an attack you regard as unjustified, the best thing to do may be to sit there and not say a word. If you have asked an honest question to which they have provided an insufficient answer, just wait. People tend to feel uncomfortable with silence, particularly if they have doubts about the merits of something they have said. For example, if a teacher's representative asks, "Why shouldn't teachers have a say in layoff policy?" the school board chairman might find himself at a loss. "Layoffs are a purely administrative matter." Well, of course teachers have an interest in layoff policy, but they really aren't the best qualified to know who's a good teacher. What I mean is... Silence often creates the impression of a stalemate that the other side will feel impelled to break by answering your question or coming up with a new suggestion. When you ask questions, pause. Don't take them off the hook by going right on with another question or some comment of your own. Some of the most effective negotiating you will ever do is when you are not talking. Consider the one-text procedure. You will probably call in a third party only if your own efforts to shift the game from positional bargaining to principled negotiation have failed. The problem you face may be illustrated by a simple story of a negotiation between a husband and wife who plan to build a new house. The wife is thinking of a two-story house with a chimney and a bay window. The husband is thinking of a modern one-story ranch-style house with a den and a garage with a lot of storage space. In the process of negotiating, each asks the other a number of questions, like, "What are your views on the living room, and do you really insist on having it your way?" Through answering such questions, two separate plans become more and more fixed. They each ask an architect to prepare first a sketch and then more detailed plans, ever more firmly digging themselves into their respective positions. In response to the wife's demand for some flexibility, the husband agrees to reduce the length of the garage by 1 foot. In response to his insistence on a concession, the wife agrees to give up a back porch, which she says she had always wanted, but which did not even appear on her plan. Each argues in support of one plan and against the other. In the process, feelings are hurt and communication becomes difficult. Neither side wants to make a concession, since it will likely lead only to requests for more concessions. This is a classic case of positional bargaining. If you cannot change the process to one of seeking a solution on the merits, perhaps a third party can. More easily than one of those directly involved, a mediator can separate the people from the problem and direct the discussion to interests and options. Further, he or she can often suggest some impartial basis for resolving differences. A third party can also separate inventing from decision-making, reduce the number of decisions required to reach agreement, and help the parties know what they will get when they do decide. One process designed to enable a third party to do all this is known as the one-text procedure. In the house designing negotiation between husband and wife, an independent architect is called in and shown the latest plans reflecting the present positions of the husband and the wife. Not all third parties will behave wisely. One architect, for example, might ask the parties for clarification of their positions, press them for a long series of concessions, and make them even more emotionally attached to their particular solutions. But an architect using the one-text procedure would behave differently. Rather than ask about their positions, he asks about their interests, not how big a bay window the wife wants, but why she wants it. Is it for morning sun or afternoon sun? Is it to look out or look in? He would ask the husband, why do you want a garage? What things do you need to store? What do you expect to do in your den? Read? Look at television? Entertain friends? When will you use the den? During the day? Weekends? Evenings? And so forth. The architect makes clear he is not asking either spouse to give up a position. Rather, he is exploring the possibility that he might be able to make a recommendation to them. But even that is uncertain. At this stage, he is just trying to learn all he can about their needs and interests. Afterward, the architect develops a list of interests and needs of the two spouses. Morning sun, open fireplace, comfortable place to read, room for a wood shop, storage for snowblower and medium-sized car, and so on. He asks each spouse in turn to criticize the list and suggest improvements on it. It is hard to make concessions, but it is easy to criticize. A few days later, the architect returns with a rough floor plan. Personally, I'm dissatisfied with it, but before working on it further, I thought I would get your criticisms. What would be wrong with something like this? The husband might say, what's wrong with it? Well, for one thing, the bathroom is too far from the bedroom. I don't see enough room for my books. And where would overnight guests sleep? The wife is similarly asked for a criticism of the first sketch. A short time later, the architect comes back with a second sketch, again asking for criticism. I've tried to deal with the bathroom problem and the book problem, and also with the idea of using the den as a spare bedroom and adding more storage space. What do you think about this? As the plan takes shape, each spouse will tend to raise those issues most important to him or to her, not trivial details. Without conceding anything, the wife, for example, will want to make sure that the architect fully understands her major needs. No one's ego, not even that of the architect, is committed to any draft. Inventing the best possible reconciliation of their interests within their financial constraints is separated from making decisions and is free of the fear of making an overhasty commitment. Husband and wife do not have to abandon their positions, but they now sit side by side, at least figuratively, jointly critiquing the plans as they take shape and helping the architect prepare a recommendation he may later present to them. And so it goes, through a third plan, a fourth, and a fifth. Finally, when he feels he can improve it no further, the architect says, "This is the best I can do. I've tried to reconcile your various interests as best I could. Many of the issues I have resolved using standard architectural and engineering solutions, precedent, and the best professional judgment I can bring to bear. Here it is. I recommend you accept this plan." Each spouse now has only one decision to make, yes or no. In making their decisions, they know exactly what they are going to get, and a yes answer can be made contingent on the other side's also saying yes. The one-text procedure not only shifts the game away from positional bargaining, it greatly simplifies the process both of inventing options and of deciding jointly on one. In other negotiations, who could play the role of the architect? You could invite a third party in to mediate, or in negotiations involving more than two parties, a natural third party may be a participant whose interests on this issue lie more in effecting an agreement than in affecting the particular terms. In many negotiations, that someone may be you. For instance, you may be a sales representative for a plastics plant negotiating a large order with an industrial customer who makes plastic bottles. The customer may want a special kind of plastic made up, but the plant you represent may be reluctant to do the retooling needed for the order. Your commission depends more on effecting an agreement between your customer and your production people than on affecting the terms. Or you may be a legislative assistant for a senator who is more concerned with getting a certain appropriations bill passed than with whether the appropriation is $10 million or $11. Or you may be a manager trying to decide an issue on which each of your two subordinates favors a different course of action. You care more about making a decision both can live with than about which alternative is chosen. In each of these cases, even though you are an active participant, it may be in your best interest to behave as a mediator would and to use the one text procedure. Mediate your own dispute. Perhaps the most famous use of the one text procedure was by the United States at the Camp David summit in September 1978 when mediating between Egypt and Israel. The United States listened to both sides, prepared a draft to which no one was committed, asked for criticism, and improved the draft again and again until the mediators felt they could improve it no further. After 13 days and some 23 drafts, the United States had a text it was prepared to recommend. When President Jimmy Carter finally did recommend it, Israel and Egypt accepted. As a mechanical technique for limiting the number of decisions, reducing the uncertainty of each decision, and preventing the parties from getting increasingly locked into their positions, it worked remarkably well. The one text procedure is a great help for two-party negotiations involving a mediator. It is almost essential for large multilateral negotiations. 150 nations, for example, cannot constructively discuss 150 different proposals, nor can they make concessions contingent upon mutual concessions by everybody else. Combining parts of many different proposals is also unlikely to produce the best answer, as illustrated by the old quip that a camel is a horse designed by a committee. Multiple parties need some way to simplify the process of decision-making without diminishing the quality of the outcome. The one-text procedure serves that purpose. The Law of the Sea negotiations started making significant progress only when they began using a prototype of the one-text procedure created by veteran diplomat Tommy Koh of Singapore. The negotiators were divided into groups to work on different issues with appointed chairpersons tabling drafts, soliciting criticism, and revising drafts within each group. A similar process was used for parts of the South African constitutional negotiations that ultimately ended apartheid and created an inclusive multilateral democracy. Note that in most situations you do not have to get anyone's consent to start using the one-text procedure. Simply prepare a draft and ask for criticism. Again, you can change the game simply by starting to play the new one. Even if the other side is not willing to talk to you directly, or vice versa, a third party can take a draft around. Getting them to play. The case of Jones Realty and Frank Turnbull. The following real-life example of a negotiation between a landlord and tenant should give you a feel for how you might deal with a party who is reluctant to engage in principled negotiation. It illustrates what it means to change the game by starting to play a new one. The case in brief. Frank Turnbull rented an apartment in March from Jones Realty for $1,200 a month. In July, when he and his roommate Paul wanted to move out, Turnbull learned that the apartment was under rent control. The maximum legal rent was $932 a month, $268 less than he had been paying. Disturbed that he had been overcharged, Turnbull called on Mrs. Jones of Jones Realty to discuss the problem. At first, Mrs. Jones was unreceptive and hostile. She claimed to be right and accused Turnbull of ingratitude and blackmail. After several long negotiating sessions, however, Mrs. Jones agreed to reimburse Turnbull and his roommate. Her tone in the end became friendly and apologetic. Throughout, Turnbull used the method of principled negotiation. Here is a selection of the exchanges that took place during the negotiation. Each exchange starts with a stock phrase that a principled negotiator might use in any similar situation. Following each exchange is an analysis of the theory that lies behind it and its impact. Please correct me if I'm wrong. Turnbull. Mrs. Jones, I've just learned, please correct me if I'm wrong, that our apartment's under rent control. We've been told that the legal maximum rent is $932 a month. Have we been misinformed? Analysis. The essence of principled negotiation lies in remaining open to persuasion by objective facts and principles. By cautiously treating his view of the objective facts as possibly inaccurate and asking Mr.